think we better go ahead and start. I'm Tracy Lamb. I've asked to be the moderator, and I'm also on the panelist, so there are a few things we need to, some business we need to take care of. Please turn off all your cell phones, pagers, anything else that makes noise. This is the author meets critics, talking about Levi Peterson's recent autobiography, Rascal by Nature, Christian by Yearning. And I will introduce the speakers, and then we'll just go from there. And also, I just want to mention that Levi is going to be doing...
I just wondered, is the mic on?
Can you hear? Okay.
We weren't sure.
Okay. Levi is going to be doing a book signing tomorrow at lunchtime. So if you haven't got his book yet, haven't had it signed, you'll have that opportunity. We'll just go... The book signing is just out in the foyer, I understand. Levi, do you know where it is? It has it in the program where it is, but I don't have my program. I can tell you. I'll check. We'll go in the order that it's listed in the program. I'll speak, say a few words first, and then Molly Bennion will speak. Molly graduated from Smith College in government. She did a year and a half of graduate work in history and education at the University of Washington, and she changed her career and graduated from the University of Houston in law school. She says her meager essays, although they're not, appear occasionally in Sunstone and Dialogue. She shares her life in Seattle and Chelan, Washington with Roy Bennion, four grown children and five grandchildren, and enjoys a close relationship with her saintly Congregationalist parents. She has a variety of interests, one of which that we all benefit from up in Seattle, is to chair the Northwest Sunstone Symposium. She serves on Dialogue's board. She creates a friendly environment in her home for periodic gatherings of Mormon thinkers and askers. Inflexible yoga. I'm trying to imagine what that is, Molly.
Yoga for inflexible people.
Aha. Gardening, swimming, teaching Relief Society, attending lots of theater and film, and cherishing time with her glorious grandchildren and golf. Mary Lee Mitchum. Says Mary Lee entered the Mormon Church through the back door of Sunstone, and Levi Peterson was instrumental in helping her find people in the church and its wider community that had a testimony which involved thinking, feeling, and acting for themselves in the way that seemed adult and evolved to her. She considers herself a liberal, ecumenical, serious Christian who still attends LDS meetings and who also meditates Vipassana style. She is married with four children and seven grandchildren. And then Bruce Jorgensen. He teaches creative writing at Brigham Young University and writes criticism. He writes poetry as well as fiction under the name Wayne Jorgensen. He has most recently been pursuing studies of the American fiction writers Reynolds Price, George P. Eliot, and Gina Barrialt. Jorgensen, who served as president of the Association for Mormon Letters, has written criticism that's been seminal in shaping Mormon literary tradition. Myself, I'm Tracy Lamb. I teach English as a second language up in Auburn, Washington. I've written some personal essays that have been published in Dialogue, and I edited and I was the editor and compiler of Yearning for the Living God, the memoirs of my mission president, F.N.Z.O. Bishop. Any writing I have done has been because of Levi, and I want to talk about that more later, about his encouragement and his mentoring of me as a writer. First of all, I want to talk a little about the book, and I have to tell you, as I've read through different chapters of this book and reread it and analyzed it, I've been uncomfortable, and I think I finally realized why as I was putting together this my little ideas on Levi's book. As I read the chapters and as I wrote down, looked at different parts of it that seemed to be especially important, it seems to me that just as the title is very apt, because it seems to me like Levi's, both his work and his life, are contradictions. And so the title, Showing Contradictions, is very apt, more than I'd realized, I think. And I wanted to just talk about some of the things I see as conflicts or contradictions in his book and in his life, and give a few excerpts and quotes from his book to support that, and then some ideas that I have. The first of all is the family. Family permeates the whole book. And he talks about his strong connection and strong need for his family. But at the same time, there's an equally strong need for separation and distinction. And I wanted to read a few quotes from that. For the strong need for family, he says, one of the important things in his life is keeping strong the ties of extended family. And we see that over and over. He tells about all the visits to his family. He says, I am no solitary animal. I am happiest when others are happy. He says, family is at my emotional core. Furthermore, I have a strong need to follow and participate in the doings of decent people. So repeatedly we see how family is so important and connections are so important. At the same time, he talks about how being married to Althea, it was almost strategically planned, that being married to her and not being married in the temple was a way for him to be separate from his family. He said, I need this distinction of being married to a Gentile, as he calls Althea, not being married in the temple. I need this distinction between us, between him and his family. And even his siblings' disapproval and the part where his mother begs him not to publish the stories in the Canyons of Grace, I thought to myself, how could he resist that? And yet he does, very intentionally. And he's talked about how he makes intentional, putting certain things intentionally, because he knows that will put some distance between him and his family. And then he says, and I think this explains some of it. He says, I have had a central core of personality to which nonconformity, resistance, rebellion have seemed absolutely vital and indispensable. And so these two things are in conflict and are struggling against each other throughout the whole book. Another contradiction or conflict is his need or desire or a need, I think, to be part of the Mormon church, and yet again, the need to remain distinct from it. Some examples, he said, when he realized on his mission that, I apologize, Levi, for talking in third person while you're right here. It seems rude, but all right. remains distant, there we go. When he was on his mission and realized how, even though he had tried to have belief, he simply didn't. And yet he says, I lacked the stamina for restructuring my life outside the expectation of Mormonism. He realized that he needed to stay in Mormonism. And then he says this, if I met a wavering person whose identity was deeply Mormon, I had an impulse to help that person remain in the fellowship of the church. And when I read this, I remembered. See, Levi was my advisor at Weber State. And I remembered when he said that we'd had talks and that he had done that for me, that he had helped me stay in the church. I'd forgotten that he'd done that. And then he says again, he talks about Juanita Brooks and how she was an example of loyal descent and how that was important to him. And he said, there's a place within Mormonism for the loyal dissenter, and I, for one, intend to occupy it. So he found a place for himself in Mormonism as a dissenter. But then again, and he goes, can I share this secret that you're a home teacher, Levi? Is that in the book? Levi's actually a home teacher. And yet, so he wants to belong, and yet he intentionally puts up these distinctions between himself. Coffee, a convenient sin, a handy, inexpensive way to stay out of harmony with the church. I don't even think he likes coffee. I think he just drinks it so that he can have this excuse. And then he talks about, I remember that the talk he gave at Sunstone, he talks about how they ask him what pillars of my faith or whatever, and he didn't know whether he should do that or not. He said, how could I reveal even to a liberal Mormon audience the depth of my disbelief? So even though he needs to be within Mormonism, there's this disbelief that's contrast. And then I found this saying, and I enjoyed reading this because many of the things he said helped me understand this. He said, my identity required disbelief. So at the core of what he is, Or is this a conflict, this contrast? It's very interesting to me. I hadn't seen it so clearly as when I was studying it. Another contrast is the friction between adult and child. And I have to say that I was very surprised by how much we learned about Levi and his inner workings and his childhood. But the conflict, and he talks about his pathology, the conflict between remaining a child and becoming a grown-up, and the years he spent in therapy trying to resolve that conflict, and how even yet it's a struggle for him. He says, I function today on the assumption that as a little child I internalized some terribly dysfunctional attitude that forbade me ever to grow up. He talks about how he was the youngest child of his mother, and his father was much older, and so he was alone with his mother for a lot of years, and what a close relationship he had with his mother, and yet a great deal of guilt from the fact that he grew up, that was a big deal of his, a big part of his pathology that he called it, and how he had these rituals where he'd go and be with his mother or help her in the evening. He says, this ritual, and I don't have exactly which one, but this ritual assuaged my guilt and brought a sense of reparation for my old crime of having grown up and left her. So there's this constant conflict that's a huge part of his life between remaining a child, trying to grow up and become the adult. And still in his life, and it's so interesting to me, there's this need for the parent-child connection, he says. He talks about his daughter, Karen, and now his grandsons, and how that circle of parent-child, the whole dichotomy of parent-child runs throughout his book. And he says, Karen's departure threatened to break, Karen, his daughter, left to go to school, threatened to break the magic circle of the parent-child in which my pathological anxiety found its best surcease. So that whole parent-child conflict or dichotomy. And then again, he talks about his pathological need to be within a parent-child circle. So over and over again, as I was looking closely with this, I saw this tension between the two, to the contrast of many different things. The most difficult contradiction for me, and I realized as I studied this, that this is where my discomfort came. I've been very uncomfortable sometimes with Levi's writings. I've had the privilege of being in a writer's group with him up in Washington, and so I read through many of these chapters as he was developing them, and almost always I'd feel uncomfortable afterwards, and I wasn't sure why. I like his writing, he's a wonderful writer, but I was uncomfortable, and a big part of it is his candor. I have to say, Levi, your candor is just astounding to me. Sometimes I'd read it, and I was just amazed, first of all, that he was courageous enough to reveal himself. That's one thing about this, his autobiography, is he reveals to me what are some of the most private and embarrassing, it's almost like he's his vulnerabilities and his weaknesses are revealed, opened for the world. Here, pay money so you can see what all the bad things about me. But the conflict here is what Levi says about himself and reveals about himself and the kinds of things he talks about, and the person that I knew. There seemed to be such a contrast between those two things. And yet, I think, at the beginning, Levi talks about how this began as a wilderness essay, and how it turned into an autobiography. But I think it remains a wilderness essay. And let me tell you why. He talks about, I think his autobiography is an affirmation of the wild. And I see it this way. He says, as a child, adults ordered me not to behave so wildly. So I knew the wild was something to be disapproved of and repressed, like sin, vice, and rudeness. And then he also talks about choosing literature as his major. And he said, among the values consistently associated with wilderness in literature was freedom from social restraints. And I think repeatedly in his book, Levi insists on the freedom from social restraints. Perhaps it's still this child who's insisting on being wild, and that in this is the wilderness, the wild, that he values so highly. Judy, I just left my book in my bag. Could you bring it to me? And one reason I think the whole connection of the child and the wilderness is, again, at the very end he talks about his grandson Hans and the funeral. And he says, and Hans escapes right as they're, I don't even know how you say it, the military are shooting volleys of salute for Levi's brother. And Hans escapes and runs off and is a real distraction at this time that's supposed to be very sacred. And Levi says, there's something refreshing about the indifference of the very young to protocol and propriety. And so I think perhaps this whole child thing and the wild thing and Levi's lack of propriety sometimes all come together there, perhaps. That's just an idea I had. He talks about, but the candor, I have to tell you, made me uncomfortable more than once. But he says, if I may read to you from page 11, I regard the chapter on my early college years as doubly important because it defined a pattern for my later chapters, establishing not only predominant themes, but also a style and tone. Among the important issues I had to settle while writing the chapter was candor. I knew in advance that many of my likely readers would feel uncomfortable, and then he talks about things that I can't even read. I'm embarrassed to read some of the stuff he talks about. Yet, I decided to include these facts in my chapter, thereby licensing myself to include similar facts in my later chapters. My impulse to make facts known derives in part from a resentment I have felt since early childhood toward the mandatory silence polite society imposes upon matters of sex and personal hygiene. It has puzzled me that people can't talk about instincts and behaviors known to be common to all of them. My impulse to reveal such facts also derives from my sense that without a due portion of them, my life story is not complete. I don't want to present myself as something I am not. I do not present these facts for others either to emulate or to repudiate. I present them simply because they reveal the person I was, and that is the purpose of an autobiography. Now, Levi's scatological obsession aside, I think that this is the part that makes me most uncomfortable, because he says he reveals these things not only to make his disagreement with propriety, but to reveal who he really is. And this, I realize, is my source of discomfort. Because the Levi that is in the book is not always the Levi that I have known. We're going on 30 years now. He was my advisor. We maintain contact through letters and visits. And then, as I said, recently I've had the privilege of being in a writer's group with him. And all this time, the Levi that I know isn't this Levi of going against social norms, and it's a different, much different kind of Levi. And I think that, and maybe it's that someone else needs to write a biography to show him from the outside, that he doesn't show or isn't willing or doesn't even see, perhaps, this Levi that other people know. And one of the comments from a comment from one of his nieces, Joan, expresses a lot what I feel. She said, what I object to is the picture I think they, his stories, may be painting of you, which seems in variance with the great and good man you are in my eyes. And that's where my discomfort lies with this autobiography. That the Levi I know is a very gracious person and very encouraging. When I was in one of his classes, I wanted to take, it was an honors class with Campbell, Joseph Campbell. I really wanted to take it, but I had to take another one. And they overlapped a little bit. And I went to talk to Levi, and I asked him if he thought maybe I could take both of them, even though I was going to be missing some of his classes. And he said, sure, you're a capable person. And up to that point, I had never thought of myself that way. In my depth of worry and insecurity, I'd never thought of myself like that. And he gave me that gift of helping me think of myself maybe as a capable person. As I said, I would never have written probably if Levi hadn't encouraged me, and I know I'm not the only one. I remember we were on a picnic one time. My daughter was very small, and he says, "Why don't you write about your mission experience?" And that's where it all started. And I know that he's encouraged many, many people and mentored many people. The Levi I know is amiable and gracious. Part in the book that seems most like him is actually his father. Maybe where his father, where he's very young, and he opens the gates for his father, and his father says thank you, and he says thank you, and his father says, "No, you should say you're welcome." And how his father taught him to be polite. And that's the Levi I know. A very polite and gracious and amiable person. Charitable, intelligent, very socially adept, very kind to others. So the crass, the vulgar, I don't see that as I interact with him in real life. And I think that, I hope that those reading the book that don't know him won't just think of him as a crass and vulgar person, because he is not. He is gracious, and I appreciate so much how he has contributed to the quality of my life. Thank you.
I hope we have time for discussion, because I think this could be very interesting discussion. I usually give each of my new bishops a copy of the Christianizing of Colburn Heights. Just the very week they're called, they need to read it. Some never respond, but my favorites thank me profusely. A longtime fan of Levi's work, I was so excited when Levi and Althea moved to Seattle and Levi became a regular at the Northwest Sunstone Symposium. When Levi's team applied for Dialogue's editorship, some of my colleagues on the board asked what I thought of Levi personally. I told them I enjoyed Levi, his good humor, his kindness, his generosity, his humility, his quick and sharp intellect, and his strong sense of honesty and integrity. After working sometimes closely with Levi for the last 3 years, I can tell you I have met few people of his high character. So I warn you, this will be something of a love fest. Well, I'm leaving to the literary among us to analyze more of the wilderness and a number of other themes in Levi's work. Understanding the import of all that to Levi and to his work, I will tell you about the one thing that has meant the most to me in this autobiography. The Love Fest is appropriate because Levi's autobiography is a celebration of love. His love is abundant, wide-reaching, and capable of surviving interpersonal and psychological challenges, many of which he shares in Rascal. It's a considered love, infusing a life obviously considered almost from the very beginning. Levi tells his story in rich detail, rendering the mundane the profound. Everyday details, which alone seem like the single mountain wildflower on one of his hikes, lovely but almost inconsequential, become an accumulation fields of breathtaking beauty, masses of lupine resembling a lake, one ray of truth becoming a beam of wisdom on the beauty, as well as the ambivalence and the contradiction of life. I was amused by Levi's explanation that his chief motive for providing an abundance of domestic detail in his biography of Juanita Brooks was to demonstrate how Juanita's achievement had been crowded into the complex and busy life of a wife, mother, and teacher. Levi's domestic detail of his own life does the same thing for a son, husband, father, and teacher. But the detail does even more. In accumulation, the detail separates itself into reasons and patterns. Those lupine blue mountain lakes take shape and force us to see the similar everyday details of our lives as part of the more meaningful wholes of those lives. We see where Levi was, where we are, and how we got there. Levi often sneaks in the complexities. Only after describing his parents' love for him, of his mother's unconditional love, and his feeling of the deepest love and assurance in his father's presence, does he share the terrifying psychological pain he has felt because his mother wanted him to be a girl and because she punished him physically. Levi is gentle, but he doesn't sugarcoat. The same woman who taught him affection, loyalty, and interest in his fellows, and whose chief happiness consisted of seeing her family sheltered, fed, groomed, and sent about their daily doings with equal doses of affection and discipline, wounded him. I love the honesty here. I love the honesty throughout the book. Even the most admirable and loved among us, and Levi's mother was obviously one of those, may cause pain in others. And of course, instantly, I thought of my own mothering, contemplating the inevitable pains I have inadvertently inflicted on those I love most. If you're a grandparent, you will identify with Levi's reaction to his grandson, Lars. Quote, Lars' round, expressive face elicits my deepest and almost desperate affection. In him, I sensed a symbolic restoration of the infant I had once been. In holding, feeding, and cherishing him, I set aright the old crime against my mother of having grown up and gone away. Who hasn't felt the crime of leaving home? There is much of common experience, the cycle of life, the interconnectedness of family, and the wisdom and healing to be gained by life's different stages in Rascal. Levi tells us he is, emotionally speaking, an indelible Mormon. We don't doubt it. Just as he describes himself as well-planted, fully rooted, and at home with himself, I would describe him as fully rooted in Mormonism. Thank God for a bishop who understood how right it was for Levi to bless Lars. But Levi also wants his family to be more hopeful about his chances on Judgment Day. Unable to find the anthropomorphic Mormon God, Levi finds the sacred in family, natural beauty, a natural force binding all things into the kinship of universal being. Unable to find the sacred in a God, the enemy of human appetites, a God who would grant salvation only to those who cut away all joy, or a Jesus who is not kind, Levi creates in the backslider a powerful portrait of a God whose blood is enough. A God I, a believing Mormon, recognize as my own. Levi is our Marianne, asking us why we cannot let Christ's blood be enough, why we must shed ours too. One of our greatest failings as a church is an inability fully to embrace the passions and the humor of the human condition. Another is a failure to contemplate and trust the atonement alone, or adequately. Many a member falls away because he cannot believe the blood of the kind Christ is enough. Many more struggle with guilt over passions which hurt no one, and which define us as human beings. I have to tell a story. Long ago, I was passing one of the Sunstone sessions in the hall. Perhaps Levi can give me a date, but this was quite a long time ago. A loud burst of laughter exploded through the doors. It set a record. The room was so packed I couldn't get in, but I asked what had just happened to someone who was kind of hanging on the edge of the door, trying to figure out what was going on too. Levi Peterson had just suggested our heavenly parents engaged in oral sex. And this in the wake of one of the brethren's attempts to have oral sex in marriage preclude a temple recommend. Protesting members had inundated the First Presidency's office with complaint, and eventually the campaign abruptly ended with a letter asking bishops not to inquire into a couple's sexual habits. But until the letter, the subject was on everyone's mind. The angst and guilt were palpable, and Levi's bold conclusion brought down a house sorely in need of common sense humanity. Rascal is filled with common sense humanity. Some of Levi's less important church references are equally perfect. After a bishop's worthiness interview, Levi writes that he feels violated for having conceded the bishop's moral superiority by submitting to the interrogation. Don't many of us? I like to pretend in interviews I'm answering the questions only for God, because we too are the key parties in interest. I also feel particularly violated as a woman each time I must answer personal questions from a man. Levi finds fasting, this I have to quote, a quick route into a surly and ungodly mood. Yes! I have a high metabolism adult daughter who's there after one missed meal. A day might require a padded cell. Levi is unusual in pointing out the dark side of the most commonplace experiences of our faith. There is humor and peaceful release in getting those negatives right out there on the table. Others on this panel are far better prepared to comment on Levi's autobiography as an anatomy of a writing, for he laces his book with insights into the birth of a writing. For instance, writing as a base, directional, and determinate, or of writing as a tombstone, and the fulfillment of a wish to be remembered. If you're interested in the process of writing and the drive to write, Levi will reward you here. But for me, love is the book's overriding theme. Levi writes that his mother's love infused him with a propensity to affirm and take pleasure in human beings rather than to injure or begrudge them. I've known Levi personally only a few years, but we have worked closely together in challenging situations. Always Levi's desire never to injure governs his words and deeds. Another person may injure him, and he seeks no revenge. Levi practices what he preaches. We may not harm our fellows, but we need not fear God's punishment of our passionate desires or our harmless deeds. We may lack faith, but charity, and to a lesser degree perhaps hope, are within the grasp of us all. We may cherish life without certainty of an afterlife. We can respect the visions of others, though no visions enlighten us. We can strain to understand the inexplicable for the sheer joy of the effort. And we can love and serve. And Levi does that in abundance. I know he sleeps little, so he can serve his grandsons, his beloved wife Althea, his daughter and her husband, his friends and extended family, and, to our great fortune, the Mormon intellectual community through his incredibly dedicated editorship of Dialogue and his marvelously human, honest, insightful, and delightful publications. We are part of that circle of Levi's love, and are we ever lucky?
Levi, it really was, oh, thank you. It really was a tremendous privilege to read your much anticipated autobiography. I approached it with pleasure every time I took it up again. Like your other work, it was challenging in a purely fruitful way. I stopped many times with reveries around one thing or another, some intellectual, some emotional, and others related to the craft of writing. I also turned again and again to the photographs, which, as an aside, were revelatory of the genes I share with two of your half-sisters. Looking at the childhood pictures of them, I was astonished at how familiar the body language was of the two Smith-Peterson girls. Photographically, at least, Lenora resembled my mother, Mary, my daughter, one of my daughters. When I turned to the photograph of the grown Peterson siblings and spouses in 1993, I got a second zing by knowing immediately which woman was a Smith Peterson by the way she sat for the photograph. Again, it looked like the way my mother did it. Given that Jesse N. Smith III was not someone I'm pleased to share genes with, it was doubly rewarding to admire young Mary and Lenora, who so visually appeared as known by blood. Moving on, I'm not too proud to admit that the first thing I did after getting your book was to look for what you said about me. You'd warned me that it wasn't much, so I wasn't surprised to find three sentences. Quote, a Catholic woman in Brooklyn, Mary Lee Mitchum, descended from lapsed Mormons, wrote me that she had picked up the book in a used bookstore. Mary Lee and I would correspond with considerable candor throughout the following decade. Eventually, she would convert to the Mormonism that her ancestors had abandoned. End quote. That is a truly masterful job of condensation. Even though I was an unofficial and off-the-record friend, as you put it, your swift reference to me does not leave me feeling slighted. Moreover, your ability to condense gave me a new appreciation of that word, which formerly had the ring of Reader's Digest condensed books, about 90% of the books in my home as I was growing up. You have rehabilitated the whole concept, given it a startling depth and mystery. All of a sudden, it's a skill I want to acquire. As my sometimes editor, I know you'll be pleased. And in the future, when you find me imitating your writing style in the way you've structured and handled the inner and outer events of a long life, you'll know it's that sincerest form of flattery. As to theme, I'll also be yours in adopting the list you made for a liberal Mormon audience. That's on page 273. You say, variety and balance, comedy, tragedy, heroism, romance, reverence, problems, disillusionment. In my yet unwritten book, what's relevant for fiction is going to be relevant for life, or even for this paper today. One, comedy. Your fiction is full of it. And I love the nonfiction stories of numerous escapades, from squatting on poison ivy to teasing the cows by writhing in mock agony to unsuccessfully fornicating in a car because neither of you knew how the deed was done. But prepare yourself, because I do have one out-and-out criticism of you in this regard. Some comedic synapse in your brain went amiss when later on in the book you described Althea as having a ski jump nose, even if she said it about herself. That would have hurt my feelings. And the fact is, her nose is attractively unremarkable and doesn't even rate a description. I was insulted on her behalf and think you owe her an apology. There's also something I wanted to say to Althea for a long time, and I thought she would be here, but I'm saying it long distance here. I wanted to say for a long time, based on a somewhat comedic one-night visit I made at your 25th Street house in August of 1991. I had flown to Salt Lake City and rented a car in order to visit ancestral sites north of that city. I found myself realizing as I was driving through Ogden that I remembered your address from our long correspondence. Too shy to drop in, I nevertheless was led by curiosity to see where you lived. So, like a groupie perhaps, I drove slowly by your house. Then, distractedly pulling into the nearest gas station, I hit a curb, damaging the car so badly that I had to wait overnight for a replacement. Contemplating my bad driving, I saw this as a sign of the Holy Spirit, that the Holy Spirit wanted me to say hello in person, since I had broken down within walking distance of your house. When I phoned, I received both an invitation to dinner and an overnight. Not only that, but while your wife cooked the meal, Levi, you and I had the luxury of strolling in the backyard, free to talk one-on-one. Althea, thank you for more than exemplary generosity. I want you to know that while I bask in the glow of the time I had with Levi, I simultaneously commiserated with you. We are both of us married to tall, handsome academics who engender female attention, even ardor. I remember many times when the shoe was on the other foot, but I doubt that I was as sincerely kind as you were at hosting my husband's women admirers. Reading Levi's autobiography brought into focus for me how lucky he's been in his marriage. Were it not for a wife of your caliber, I feel he might have brought himself to a real standstill. I hope you know that the readers of this book have been brought to understand the depth of love he has for you. I certainly do. Tragedy. Interesting, I get a frog in my throat here. Because I'm a grief-stricken human being at heart, the emotional center of your book for me was this sentence, "I don't want dead." Thanks. Alma's words to his and your mother put a gash in my heart, and I honestly hope I can forget this sentence so that place will heal over. It's comforting to think that having spoken few words in his brief life, he speaks volumes here in print for years and years to come. Heroism. That would be your continuing effort to come to terms with your pathology, as you put it, and to carry as much of the weight of it yourself as you could. You've kept most of the agony to yourself, most of your life. Now that it's revealed to your many friends, relatives, and readers, I hope it might shift a little. You deserve a lighter burden, God willing. I want to credit you with the many skills you had to learn to lead such a rich, productive life under great emotional strain. I've just been reading a book by Eugene Rolfe titled Encounter with Jung that addresses similar mental torments from a Jungian perspective. Rolfe says, and I quote him on page 8 or 9, "As I'd had no more success in killing myself than in downing masturbation, I just had to go on living. In the end, after 2 years' struggle or more, I finally succeeded in breaking the habit. I was rewarded with a first-class anxiety disorder." And he says, "There wasn't a soul among my soul's mentors, not even an emancipated uncle, who had the slightest spark of that picaresque, rueful, ironic acceptance of sex, which would have been the perfect antidote to my condition. It was all deadly reverent and solemn and moralistic," end quote. It seems to me that your fiction saved you when something providential inspired you to create it, because your stories are the perfect antidote in their picaresque, rueful, ironic acceptances. You mentioned D.H. Lawrence in your autobiography, specifically the reference to his erotic imagery. You write that you, quote, "gather that the sexually explicit has its own proportionate and unapologetic place in literature," end quote. I certainly agree. D.H. Lawrence was a serious influence in Carl's and my early marriage. Our first ceremony was simply a legal one in the courthouse in 1965, but we also had a Catholic mass and marriage ceremony in 1969. At which, besides the gospel, we also read from an essay by Lawrence titled Apropos of Lady Chatterley's Lover. You can do that in the Catholic Church. It's to be found in a book of his essays edited by Harry T. Moore in a slim volume titled Sex, Literature, and Censorship. I no longer remember the exact parts we chose, but I can never forget some of it, particularly this. A. The old church knew that life is here our portion, to be lived in fulfillment. B. The rhythm of life was preserved by the church, hour by hour, day by day, season by season, year by year, epoch by epoch, down among the people, and the wild coruscations were accommodated to this permanent rhythm. End quote. C. Augustine said that God created the universe new every day, and to the living, emotional soul, this is true. D. And this is the part that made me cry so hard, we had to stop the ceremony until I could get better control of my emotions. It brings in the wild again, the essential connection between sex and your other love, wilderness, or as Lawrence sometimes calls it, the rhythm of life. He says, "Sex goes through the rhythm of the year, in man and woman, ceaselessly changing. The rhythm of the sun in relation to the earth. Oh, what a catastrophe for man when he cut himself off from the rhythm of the year, from his unison with the sun and the earth. Oh, what a catastrophe, what a maiming of love when it was made a personal, merely personal feeling, taken away from the rising and setting of the sun and cut off from the magic connection of the solstice and equinox. This is what is the matter with us," he says. "We are bleeding at the roots because we are cut off from the earth and the sun and the stars. And love is a grinning mockery because, poor blossom, we plucked it from its stem on the tree of life and expected it to keep on blooming in our civilized vase on the table." Levi, this is part of your heroism. To speak the forbidden for the sake of developing, fulfilling, sustaining, and nourishing the enduring needs of men and women. Okay, we didn't have to stop the ceremony as long as we did when I got married and read that part. Okay, back to my series on what to include for a liberal Mormon audience. Romance. Thanks for seeing romance for the good it is and for the good it isn't. 5, reverence. Your reverence for wilderness is something I learned about you from your book. We didn't correspond about it, but we both agree. There is no well-being without that which is wild. 6, problems. Here I ask myself if you had converted sin into a mental problem for yourself. For me, that no matter how hard we try, sin still clings to us. Well, I accept it as just one more thing that carries meaning in our quest for greater enlightenment. Perhaps it's only God's way of getting our deeper attention. Thinking that no one is born a sinner is not helpful to me because it seems to diminish the life-altering role of heaven's initiative, which is the only thing I found in life that I can truly count on. A day later, I decided that according to your theological interpretation of life, sin isn't a problem. We disagree about what it is, but neither of us sees it as a problem. Now, a problem for me is the ceaseless Sunday activity of Mormons. In the novel Gilead by Mary Lynn Robinson, I came across this lovely passage on page 20. Sometimes I have loved the peacefulness of an ordinary Sunday. It is like standing in a newly planted garden after a warm rain. You can feel the silent and invisible life. All it needs from you is that you take care not to trample on it. That's the kind of Mormon I am, whether it's relevant to the tradition or not. And because you sleep in church, I'm willing to make you an honorary member of my group. And 7, finally, disillusionment. What a note to end on. I hope you aren't disillusioned that I stole your list and turned it into a literary artifice. My teeming brain needed the structure to practice the art of condensing. Oh, and one more thing. Did you realize that the man who interviewed you for your mission was my great uncle? How cool is that? The end.
I don't know if it's the best thing to end with the academic, who's all too likely to prove pedantic. I will begin with a bit of pedantry. That essay, apropos of Lady Chatterley's Lover, is also in a collection of pieces by D.H. Lawrence entitled Phoenix 2, in case some of you want to look for it. I wanted to say that for me, the Levi in the book, both subject and writer, though I learn a great deal about the subject I didn't know before, does seem pretty much the Levi that I've known or thought I've known. I don't find in his stories, his fiction, stories and novels, a picture of him that's really much at variance with the man I've thought I've known. And I was reflecting here, that perhaps the main gift, or one of the main gifts, of Levi to my life has been a certain sweetness. I think of it as a sweetness that begins to concentrate in at least some men as they grow older, as in fruit, as it ripens. Now you've got to understand, I prefer both apricots and Italian plums while they still crunch in my teeth. And in apples, I've always preferred the tart. But the sweetness discoverable in some men as they age is deep and nourishing, even, or perhaps most, when joined with some acidic sharpness. It is never cloying. Perhaps in Levi, it is the flavor and odor of his Comic Sans. I just thought that up. Though actually I've been thinking it for a long time and wondering if I would ever discover that in myself. I suspect that many, Perhaps most members of the church that Joseph Smith founded also belonged to the very large club he also founded, with no dues, no meetings, no callings or assignments or reports, no hierarchy, and entire freedom to sign on and sign off as one wishes. The No Man Knows My History Club. Its complete charter and bylaws are admirably succinct and simple. I cannot tell it. I shall never undertake it. Just this spring, I've read the published autobiographies of two older men I know and admire, the late Wayne Booth and the thankfully still living Levi Peterson, and I find myself amazed and daunted by the detail that each in his very different way was able to recall and present and analyze in the effort to give an account of his life, to understand a self and its history. Each seems to have kept copious diaries or journals from adolescence on, recording events, sights and doings, reading and thinking and feeling. Their books make me wish we had many more of their candid, self-searching, and relatively unsparing kind, perhaps especially by general authorities. Parenthetically, would they ever tell us of their wounds, misdeeds, guilt, doubt? Maybe they had none. I've been Levi's friend for roughly a quarter century, maybe almost exactly a quarter century, so I can hardly be considered an unbiased critic of his work. My impulse is to celebrate and give thanks. Still, I do have a few minor cavils, think of them as pedantic if you like, to register concerning a rascal by nature, a Christian by yearning, maybe a few small emendations. I honestly don't recall that we backpacked into the Uintas more than once or twice a year. Levi's estimate is much higher. Would that it had been so often. Though for several years, that was indeed a summer exploration we, and by that I mean I and my wife Donna, we looked forward to and took glad part in, even when it rained or hailed on us, and brothers and sisters, it did. And Levi, I think, will attest to the same. I don't recall that it was all on one and the same trip that we ate the wonderful fish, the best I've ever had, out of the lake and into the frying pan and onto our plates, and Dennis Clark and I waded naked into a lake on our way back, and I read Pascal on the trail. But I can't swear either that those didn't all happen on one trip. I do mildly object to Levi's use of the verb disrobed. We stripped, or we shucked off, but we didn't disrobe, which would be much too formal a gesture for Dennis or me in that time and place. I regret, too, Levi's omission of one detail in the lamentable episode of the imitation maple syrup at breakfast in Jean and Charlotte England's cabin on the upper Weber River. Not only did Levi justify his deceptive replacement of the real thing with the ersatz on the ground that Dennis and I couldn't tell the difference, which might be true, but he also said, which I think is or at least was also true, that we liked our food hot, greasy, and copious. That's too good a phrase to have left out. Those bits are funny. They're meant to be a little funny. But, of course, they raise a serious point. The other side of this point, or the hind end of this point, is condensation. That no matter how honest, how candid the writer of an autobiography, a lifer writing a life, to use Wayne Booth's shorter words, no matter how candid the writer may try to be, to write an account at all is to select from diction and detail on up what to put in and what to leave out. There can be no perfect or complete account, no whole truth and nothing but the truth version of a life, not by the lifer who lived it, not by anybody else, which word, after all, is the truth or more true, disrobed or stripped. Perhaps a full and true account could be given by God on the assumption of omniscience, but he's not known or reported yet to have written anyone's life. And if he did write one into any mortal language, might it not prove interminable, infinite in all directions? A deep problem for the lifer writing a life lurks here. A deeper version of Aristotle's observation that one person's entire life would not comprise a single coherent action. I can't hope to discern any final shape for or meaning in my life while I'm still in it and at it. I must die to get any presumably stable perspective from outside it. And once I've done that, why write or whom tell? So we have the genre often called crisis autobiography, in which the writer, after a life-changing event or defining moment, say a conversion, in which he dies out of his old life into a new life, can look back and write the story of the self that was. It's not the supposedly final and absolutely outside perspective of God, but for us here in the midst, it will have to suffice. Augustine is, for most readers, the great originator of the crisis autobiography in Western civilization and literature. Now we get the real pedantry here, bear with me. And his Confessions, or Testimony, as Gary Wills prefers to translate it, the great originary example of the genre. Once Augustine has told, in Book 8, his final converting moment in the garden in Milan, he hasn't much left to tell. Mainly, in Book 9, the last days and death of his mother Monica. After that, he ponders memory itself in Book 10, and then performs in Books 11, 12, and 13 a dense and fascinating exegesis of the creation in Genesis as an analog of the creation of the human soul. Most of Levi's readers will know his short story, The Confessions of Augustine, and its narrator, Fremont Dunham's self-comparison with portions of the youthful career of Augustine, and may accept that as warrant enough to ponder an affinity or even some sort of filiation, sonship, between St. Augustine's Confessions and the Confessions of Levi Peterson. At least for me, as another who feels affinity or perhaps filiation with Augustine, and may also have carried him along on a backpacking trip, it feels also inevitable to think back and forth between the two, tracking a few similarities and differences. The life of a pagan becoming Christian in the 4th century will be a very different life from that of a rascal by nature Mormon becoming a Christian by yearning in the late 20th century. Once Augustine has told the story of Christian conversion, and with that story converted or steadied so many of us later Christians, what other stories will there be to tell? One, starting from within rather than without a church, might be the story of reversion, or deconversion, as some call it. And both Wayne Booth's and Levi Peterson's lives tell us something of that. But that is not the whole story either has to tell. There may be reversions upon reversions, or partial reversions. And that's something I have no time to go into. Peter Brown writes of Augustine that what he remembered in the Confessions was his inner life, and this inner life is dominated by one figure, his mother Monica. That's not true of Levi Peterson. He remembers a great deal of his outer life, and his inner life is dominated, I would rather say inhabited, by numerous others, especially, to stay with the feminine tenets, his wife Althea, and his daughter Karen. And yet Levi's mother plays an immense part in his life that I, at some moments, find somewhat analogous to Monica's role in Augustine's, though less interesting in its similarities than in its differences. I want you to listen to a couple of moments, one from each life. From the Confessions of Augustine, Book 9, Chapter 10, Augustine's last conversation with his mother Monica. And if you want to open your scriptures here, Levi's chapter 20. With the approach of that day on which she was to depart from this life, a day that you knew, although it was unknown to us, it came about, as you yourself ordered it, so I believe in your secret ways, that she and I stood leaning out from a certain window, where we could look into the garden within the house we had taken at Ostia on the Tiber, where, removed from crowds, we were resting up after the hardships of a long journey in preparation for the voyage back to North Africa. We were alone, conversing together most tenderly. And Augustine goes on to tell us that, I'll just have to read you a sentence or two more if I can manage it. When our discourse had been brought to the point that the highest delight of fleshly senses in the brightest corporeal light, when set against the sweetness of that life, the heavenly life, seemed unworthy not merely of comparison with it, but even of remembrance, then raising ourselves up with a more ardent love to the self-same, we proceeded step by step through all bodily things up to that heaven whence shine the sun and the moon and the stars down upon the earth. We ascended higher yet by means of inward thought and discourse and admiration of your works, and we came to our own minds. We transcended them so that we attained to that region of abundance that never fails. What Augustine gives us in this marvelous chapter is a moment of beatific vision, I suppose, an incredibly transcendent moment in which finally, at the end, he reports that his mother Monica said, "What am I doing here?" And she dies shortly after that. It's one of the great moments in that book. Now from the Confessions of Levi Peterson, a rascal by nature, a Christian by yearning, chapter 20, My Mother's House, from his last conversations with his mother in Snowflake, Arizona, in September 1985. Page 305, if you're really into this. He's visiting his mother for about a week in Snowflake. On perhaps the second morning, she said something that riveted my attention. From the sofa, she looked toward the door entering the kitchen. "Right there," she said, "was where your father and I completed the ceremony for our second blessing." Well, Levi's all on fire to learn about what that means. "Right where?" "There, in the doorway to the kitchen. He sat in a chair. I cried. He thought it was because I was humiliated. It wasn't that at all. I cried because it was so sacred." Well, he can't get out of her what it was, and he finds a way. He makes a guess. And on the last day at the house, on a trip to the town dump, he calls it the county landfill, but I swear that, well, maybe they called it that by 1985. In my hometown, we called it the trash pile, okay? Anyway, he says, "As we left the landfill, I launched a deceit, pretending that I knew from other sources the full ritual of the second blessing. I said to my mother, 'It's a lovely ceremony, the washing of the feet that follows the second blessing in the temple.' My ruse worked. Disarmed by this evidence that I knew, she confirmed my surmise. She spoke of kneeling, of placing my father's feet in a basin of water, of drying them, of weeping." Now, as I say, the differences matter more than the similarity. And those are, for me, two of the most moving moments in either of these lives. The difference is, once we start to take account of them, will start to show us, I think, some of what it means to call a written life, as Levi Peterson does in the subtitle of his book, A Mormon Autobiography. Thank you.
Well, I'll say a few things, and then we can see if you people have some comments or questions that you would like to ask. I'm very honored by what has been said and by all of you, all four of these comments, and I'm hesitant to say that there's been anything critical of me said, but even if there has been, it's much better to have something critical said about you than nothing at all. Now, that's always been my theory, and that's why I've never felt bad about negative book reviews. But it seemed to me that what you've all said here to me today has been very much an honor to me, and I appreciate it very much. Tracy has left, and I would simply say that she spoke of the conflict in the contradictions between myself and family, the family religion, and my having married a Gentile woman to whom I remain married these 48 years later. And my question would be, well, is that a conflict or is it a reconciliation? It would seem to me one thing to say is that I reconciled the conflicts I had and became comfortable with them. And I became reconciled to the conflict I felt in getting up from writing wicked stories for the Canyons of Grace and going over to church and sitting with good people and participating in the gospel doctrine class. And I asked myself, why am I doing this, and isn't there something insane about me that I leave that kind of seditious writing and walk immediately over to participate with the saints in holy doings? And pretty soon it dawned on me, no, it's the very fact that I can do it shows that I'm not crazy. The sanity lies in that I can do it comfortably. And so and I have to say, Tracy, I maintain being a home teacher because it does buy me a little stock in the ward. And besides, it's an observation point. You can't tell what'll show up in my next book from what I see in people's homes. As far as my candor is concerned, I was afraid it would people would respond that way, and many will. And I appreciate, Tracy, your tolerance of me and acceptance, because she has not broken off discourse with me. We maintain our friendship, despite her having read the autobiography. My brother says that, he says, well, Levi, it is a pretty candid book. He says, on Judgment Day, when the great and dreadful day of the Lord, when we're told that all will stand forth revealed to the entire world, there will be no problem for you because the whole world already knows it. I recommend it, actually. Molly, thank you for the high character you attribute to me. That's you honor me greatly, and you honor me for common sense. I would feel very flattered indeed if I show some common sense kind of wisdom. For Mary Lee, I appreciate her many years of friendship and correspondence, and we had an excellent exchange of letters over the years. And since Mary Lee demands it of me, I apologize to Althea but I couldn't quite hear what it was that I had that you took exception to. I didn't quite hear your voice. Oh, her nose.
Yes.
Her ski jump nose. Well, that was a term she used. She warned me before I saw her father. She said, you'll discover that I have inherited his ski jump nose. And it was true. But I never regarded it as a deformity. Nor did I think Althea. But at any rate, Mary Lee's praise for Althea is well-founded. Althea was a kind of a lifesaver for me, and remains such. As for Bruce, he speaks of my conflation of events. He thinks we had several trips to the Uinta Mountains. We backpacked as friends, Althea and I, with Bruce and Donna Jorgensen and with Dennis and Valerie Clark. And for several summers, we hiked over Rocky Sea Pass in the Uinta Mountains. It's a considerable pack trip, about 12 miles. And then camped on a lake. And the event I described had occurred in a a very dry summer. It was a summer of 88, in fact, when the big Yellowstone fires occurred. And we had been advised by a ranger where we might find a spring still running. So we camped on a very small lake with a running spring, which was nice. And just at supper time, as we were preparing our evening meal, I walked to the edge of this very small lake with a fishing rod and a bubble and a fly tied with a long leader to a casting bubble. And one after another, I pulled six pan-sized trout out, and that's what Bruce was referring to, which we fried immediately in butter and ate, and it was good. But the event he's referring to as we hiked out, I had us coming in and on the trip, and Bruce was quoting from Pascal, expatiating on Pascal as I was hiking behind him. And I was thinking about this essay, The Pillars of My Faith, that I was going to write, that one of you alluded to. And Bruce was quoting Pascal, and I just struck me as an anomaly that this was happening. And then as we returned from our camp out, Bruce and Dennis, and this is the literal truth, disrobed and walked into a pond. And Althea and Valerie and Donna sheltered themselves behind some trees so they wouldn't see these nude men with their buttocks shining out in that water. That's what Bruce is referring to. Well, suppose I did engage in what's called conflation. It's entirely possible that I took two or three events and two or three backpack trips and fused them. But as Bruce said, it would be for the sake of economy. I've already read a critique of my autobiography on a blog site that is troubled by the lack of coherence in my chapters. I move from one detail to another. For example, talking about some highly emotional event, and then in the very next brief paragraph talking about buying a new electric blue Ford pickup. Or opening a chapter with the fact that I trapped a skunk who had been eating our corn one summer and had to shoot it, and its stench filled the neighborhood, and I eventually got it into a cardboard box and into the back of my pickup and conveyed it to the Weber County landfill. And at 25th Street, 24th Street stoplight, sitting there with that dead skunk odor emanating from the cardboard box in the back of my pickup, I noticed an open Jeep pulled up. Two young men sat there by the red light, and soon they were sniffing and looking around. And as I comment at the end of the paragraph, you can't tell where you'll smell a skunk in Ogden. But at any rate, I give no introduction and no other explanation. Then I go on to other affairs. Well, it was frankly economy. I think I will have some criticism from my autobiography because of its length, too much detail, and it's too long. Well, there could have been a lot more, and one way of trying to achieve that economy was to dispense with transitions that would have at least helped smooth the way into that kind of abrupt thing. Well, I think that's enough by way of commentary for me. I do feel honored, and thank you. Are there questions or answers or questions I could answer or comments people would like to make? Anyone? Please.
I'll just say I enjoyed it very much. In fact, I think I've probably read everything you've written and always enjoyed it and found it not faith-destroying, but somehow faith-affirming in some way. But let's see. You start by talking about how it's going to be a wilderness essay, and there are some passages, many of which seem to have been taken from writings you made, you know, as you were different stages of life. And I found that writing to be very different than the narrative prose that, you know, joined all that together. And I'm wondering if that's a product. Seemed to be more poetic, well, I shouldn't say this maybe, but it was harder for me to enjoy as much as I did some of the other stuff. So I'm wondering if that was a product of just your feelings about the wilderness, or if your writing has evolved as as your life has progressed.
It's true. Interjected a good deal of things I had actually written, passages written and published in various places into the autobiography. And I often interjected them verbatim or nearly so, with little and often without any recognition, so that it was outright theft of things I had written before. But I did it quite purposefully, obviously, and partly because I had determined from long ago that when I did write my autobiography, I would discuss a good deal about my own writings. The first model I had for writing an autobiography was that of Albert Schweitzer, his from Out of My Life and Thought. Now, I was dissatisfied with Schweitzer's autobiography in that he gives very little about personal detail, and most of it is about his thinking and his writing, and a good many of the chapters in his autobiography are summaries of his books. And I determined that would be part of the kind of autobiography I wanted to write. I wanted to write something that would summarize my intellectual life, as that seemed to do. But I also, of course, brought in a good deal of personal detail, because I felt like that has a proper place in an autobiography. But it was something of a whim to often bring in passages that you will actually find. You'll find some passages from my story, The Confessions of Augustine, in the description of my logging in the Arizona mountains, which of course is where my feelings and attitude towards wilderness began coalescing. So I suppose I won't apologize for that, but I find it interesting your sense that there was a dissonance created by that, and it would seem to me to be a valid criticism. Other comments or questions? Karen?
Could you describe a little the process, how you were putting things together and how you felt about that?
Of assembling, writing it, organizing it and all? Well, I, of course, started with thinking about it and trying to organize it, and as I say, I spent a great deal of time writing drafts of wilderness essays and later drafts of an autobiography without anything coalescing well until I finally did strike off that chapter on my college years, my early college years. Following that, it seemed to me I had a paradigm or a pattern to follow. I knew more closely what I wanted to do. I, of course, would do just free thinking about the topic, but you need to realize that, well, you probably do realize that I did collect over the years an enormous amount of material on myself. I think I had an instinct for that from the start, because as soon as I begin writing letters to anybody with a typewriter, I begin making a carbon of it. I maybe had a model for that, but I don't remember, but I did it. So that I had many letters dating from while I was on my mission, when I acquired a typewriter. And I also, people gave me my handwritten letters. My mother saved many and gave them to me, and so on. And then I did have this compulsion to keep diaries and journals. And they were spasmodic, except for the 15 years following my biography of Juanita. Taking example from Juanita, I began keeping a regular diary after that. But still, I had a good deal of material to consult. So that one of my problems in writing the autobiography was how to bring all that massive detail about myself under control. And incidentally, as I would read my old letters and my journal entries and so on, thoughts would occur to me on or other memories would occur. It would kick me into a memory mode. I think a lot of people, even at my forgetful age, don't realize how much they could remember if they had something to trigger the memories, get them thinking about it. Because it seemed to me that I did a good deal uncover a lot of new memories, perhaps conflated, that were, and sometimes erroneous. But at any rate, I then, as far as organizing it went, I was following a model of mingling both chronology and theme. Now, it seems to me that those are about your choices in an autobiography of how to organize it. You can develop it thematically or history of any kind, and autobiography is simply a kind of history. You can organize it thematically or chronologically, or most history actually is organized both thematically and chronologically, in one manner or another. And I think I can maintain that my autobiography is organized that way. It starts with before my birth, and it gets me up to this point at any rate. Well, that'll be what I'll say on that. Is there other comment or question? Please.
Levi, this is really a follow-up on the process question. At what point did you have an aha and say to yourself, I'm going to write an autobiography? And once you said that, how long did the process take? And finally, did it go together easily, or what did it fight you along the way?
Well, as I say in my chapter called The Stillborn Book, where I discussed my fairly long attempt to write a book, a collection of wilderness essays, about as early as 1992, it occurred to me I wasn't succeeding at that. And I needed to shift over to something still predominantly about wilderness, but also very much more autobiographical than what I'd been trying to write. And so I think that was the moment I first began thinking of an autobiography. It evolved slowly, in that I don't know that I thought of an autobiography quite in the manner and shape I have presently, till maybe about 1997 or 1998, because I have a long chapter about my childhood and grade school and high school that are broken down now into at least four chapters. I was trying to handle that in one chapter. But as I say, in about 1987 or 98, when I wrote that my early years at college chapter, then it occurred to me I'm going to have to go back and cover my own life in much more detail. And so I suppose that would have been that aha moment that you're speaking of. Other comments or questions? Please.
Well, I'm I'm from Snowflake, and Levi's mother was my fourth grade teacher. His sister Mary was my fifth grade teacher, and his brother Leon, or Lynn as he was known there, was my freshman English teacher in high school. And it's interesting, having had that experience from a small town, his family was known. They were the literati, I guess you would say, of the town. But it is reading Levi's work that I have been the most instructed by, and I found it to be so, it's really helped me understand his family and my own community so much better, and I really appreciate his family is a journal keeping family. One of his cousins, whom I've been friends with, has a whole wall lined with journals, but I think you have really helped possibly all of us understand our position in relation to Mormonism and our understanding how whatever our position is and however we arrived at it, that is our own truth. And I appreciate the liberating effect your work has had on me. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Lily. Appreciate that. I just hope if some other people from Snowflake read it that they maintain the same tolerant attitude that Lily shows here. Are there other questions, please?
I'm also a great fan of your writing, and I wonder if all the things that you've written or published, is there one that you would most desire to endure through many generations to represent you in your work?
Well, likely the backslider will be, for whatever degree of the remembrance I'm had in, but in the future, I suspect it'll be the backslider, and that's all right. As I say in my chapter on the backslider, that I'm happy to have written it, and as I reread it, it strikes me that if I have written anything beautiful, then that was it. I have very little impulse to change anything in that book, and so. As far as the autobiography is concerned, I don't think it will be a contender. It's that damn candor thing, Tracy, that's going to put it down. It really does make a lot of people uncomfortable, and I ponder that, and I'm still glad I wrote it that way. It seemed to me that what I've said about myself in not wanting to be known for a person I'm not, stands, and besides, I want you to know I could have said a heck of a lot more about myself than I did, so that I have some feeling of not having been candid enough, not having lived up to it. I tried to be candid about my proneness to make stupid errors, and remember, some of you who've read the book remember that when I was working for BYU in the summer 1957, leveling a farm for them with a bulldozer and an earth mover, the boss told me to go bring a three-wheeled hay swather down where the ordinary operator had left it from somewhere off in the farm. I walked up to it and discovered that fellow had parked it in a triangle of land that was created by, on two sides, a deep ditch, and on the third side, a field of ripe wheat. And I studied for 10 minutes the situation, and I could not see how that fellow could have got that swather through the ditch. And first of all, it's a difficult machine to operate. I could see that. It didn't have a steering wheel. It operated by steering clutches. And I had never operated it before, and I could see I could possibly destroy the piece of machinery if I took it through that ditch in the wrong way. I concluded finally that fellow had brought it through the wheat, and I reasoned a little bit. Is that wheat going to spring back up? Well, it must have, because he came through it, didn't he? So I went through the wheat, knocked it down, could see immediately that I was in trouble, and I was almost fired for that. And I felt very angry that the boss had sent me out on a task I wasn't capable of of doing. I can see now what I should have done. I should have walked back and said to him, I could bring that machine to you, but didn't be in 4 or 5 pieces if I did. And I didn't do that. But it gave me tolerance for other people's lack of intelligence that my own wasn't operating. And maybe this is a good place to bring up another error I've made. I've said in my autobiography on the chapter on the retrenchment in the 1990s, the retrenchment on the liberal Mormon front, that Martha Bradley was included among the excommunicated people in the purge of 1993. And that simply isn't true. Martha was then and remains now a member in good standing. And I've written an errata sheet to be inserted in your autobiography, if you have one, and to make amends for that error. But I contemplate, how could I have done that? And I suppose, well, how did I knock that wheat down? It's another instance of my proneness to make errors, and it seems to me that's an important part of what I wanted to do in my autobiography. At any rate, was to if that's the kind of guy I am, well, I need to say it. So, well, are there other comments? I think our time's up, and I appreciate. Okay. That's all right.
Thank you. Thank you.